Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Before chain restaurants and refrigerator trucks, Americans ate local. They ate seasonal, and they ate regional cuisine. Baked beans here, chitlins there, and in between ham bone and beaver tail, hoe cakes and pickled vegetables from the backyard garden. Just as the American menu was going national, a big Depression-era project captured it as it was, the way we were when it came to food. This hour On Point, we'll hear about and tuck into the food of a younger land. You can join the conversation. What do you know about our country's eating habits before burgers coast to coast, supermarkets, and Ready Whip? Would you like to go back to molasses pie, Texas chuck wagon, and Kentucky burgoo? Are you sure? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will taste some vintage grub from bygone days right here in the studio. But joining me in the studio now is Mark Kolanski, best-selling author of many books, including Cod, a biography of the fish that changed the world, and Salt, a world history. His brand new book out yesterday is The Food of a Younger Land, a portrait of American food from the lost WPA files. Mark Kolanski, it's great to have you with us.
Nice to see you, Tom.
This is quite a smorgasbord, to use just one way of putting it, a potluck of food laid out in this book, in all these documents and in all this writing. Give us a sense of where this came from. It goes right back. I mean, it turns out it's lucky it was Depression era, because that's just before we exploded and went homogenized national. But who put this together and why?
This is in 1939, 1940, so just before World War II changed everything. And it was the last project of the Federal Writers Project, which was part of the WPA.
Work Progress Administration, putting Americans to work by hook or by crook in the Depression.
Right. And the Federal Writers Project was supposed to hire writers, but in fact, the main requirement was that you were broke. And, you know, there were secretaries and school teachers and people who had always wanted to be writers. And then there were also people like Saul Bellow and Nelson Algren and John Cheever. And
so big names got work there. Ordinary folks got work there as well. And they had written about a lot of things. And then
Mainly guidebooks. And they did guidebooks to – there had been no guidebooks to America. And they did guidebooks.
We were still discovering it.
Right. And they did, you know, all 48 states and most major cities and some small places. And they kind of exhausted the guidebook idea. And they came up with this idea to do a book about how Americans eat, the foods that they eat and the traditions and the kind of gatherings. And so they told the 5,000 Federal Writers Project writers or workers, as they called them, to just send in manuscripts about food.
Go out there, talk to your neighbors, wherever you are in the country, write up what they're eating and what about it.
Right. And this information was most of it was not going to be published. It was going to be incorporated into large essays by five established writers.
So this was raw material.
Raw, unedited material. I think some of it I may have been the first person to have ever read besides the writer.
It went into the MAW. You dug it out of the Library of Congress.
Right.
And you've got a big selection of it here in The Food of a Younger Land. Wonderful title, by the way.
Right. The WPA collapsed because of World War II. In the files, they have all these correspondence. December 8th, December 9th, 1942, right after
Pearl Harbor.
All these memos going out saying, get in your copy now, because they knew
this thing is coming down.
And it didn't get in fast enough, and so the stuff was never even edited. It's completely raw stuff, and it was just dumped into the Library of Congress.
Well, thank you for bringing it back to the light of day. And, you know, but it doesn't come academic. I mean, you read through your table of contents here, and, I mean, it's just rich with, I don't know, smell and taste and feel. I mean, you've got everything from your New York literary tea to fried beaver tail. You've got, it's South Carolina backwoods barbecue and the Possum Club of Polk County, Arkansas, Florida hush puppies and Grandma Smith's Mississippi hoe cake. A tremendous regionalism that we do not have in that degree today in what they pulled up.
Yeah, you know, I growing up in the 1950s, I can remember the last vestiges of this America where you traveled around and you actually ate different food as you traveled.
It was exciting.
Yeah, yeah. And you discovered new things, and you knew where you were and what time of year it was by what you were eating.
You've got the New England May breakfast. Now, I'm not sure what that is, but one of foot washings in Alabama, I don't know that, how that
You know, the May breakfast is interesting. There were two different items on May breakfast, and I come from New England. And
tell us about it.
I have never heard of May breakfast, but apparently this was a very strong tradition that's disappeared.
What's in it?
It would be right now, just in May, having a lot of people over for this big breakfast.
Oh, it's more so. I mean, it
was a social.
This was
gathering.
As much a social as a cuisine write-up here. They said
yes,
write about the people and the food.
And in their instructions to the writers, they specifically asked for a lot of social things and social issues wherever they would come up. And there's lots of stuff about traditional African American and traditional Indian and. And, you know, there were still a few people alive who had come out west and wagons. So
you've got cooking for threshers in Nebraska. That's a scene that my grandfather used to describe very fondly when they'd all gather around and eat big. The Chitlin strut in North Carolina, a Choctaw funeral and what went along with that, a Puget Sound salmon feast, and right across here, oyster stew out of New York and Georgia possum and Florida conch and Minnesota lutefisk, Indiana persimmon pudding. Can imagine it, but never had it.
I tried. That was one recipe that I tried.
How was it?
It was pretty good.
It was sort of a sour, sweet, sour, tangy.
A bit like the taste of gingerbread, but a different, a more of a pudding texture, and that slight tanginess that persimmons have.
What was your sense of what was then compared to what is now when you looked across this huge potluck of what they wrote up about American food?
Well, you know, I think a lot of this stuff, if you really did detective work, you could still find. Mm-hmm. Like I discovered that there still are people in southern Indiana who eat
persimmon pudding.
but it takes detective work. The difference is that in 1940, this was the food. You know, so now we have these movements that talk about being more regional and more seasonal. People didn't talk about that back then. They talked about, you know, making the food that they had. That's what was available. And it's not all positive. You know, in the Northeast, it meant that you had to start canning food in September and October because between November and April, there was no fresh food.
If you wanted more than cabbage and potatoes.
Right.
It's interesting. I mean, it's very regional, and this is before there's a little refrigeration. There are ice boxes at this time, but you don't have freezers that really work for a long time. This is before major league industrialization of everything we eat came into play.
The freezing process had been invented by Clarence Birdseye, but people didn't have freezers. And you know, if they did, they were – remember those weird little boxes with a swing door? They didn't work. They just didn't work.
And we didn't have interstates. I mean, we just weren't as – what intermeshed a nation. We were a nation of regions and cultures and subcultures.
And people were very tied to their region, and they didn't move around. And, you know, I come from a huge family in the Boston area, and I don't have a single relative in the Boston area today.
You're right that this is a time when there were few suburbs, lots of farms and farming families, coastal towns, almost all of them had their fishing boats, and so direct access there, food more regional in New England, corn relish and cottage cheese and from little metal cups or popovers. I remember those in more old-fashioned restaurants. It's a kind of a funny combination. On the one hand, there's very vivid regional cooking here. You've got your burgoo and your Kentucky oysters. We'll talk about that. Well, Kentucky wilted lettuce, we'll have some. South Carolina chicken bog, I don't know what that is. Hush puppies, people know those. But in other ways, there was less diversity. I mean, today, here, there's a special note here, they're writing out of the West, about a Los Angeles sandwich called a taco.
Yes.
As if taco was something in the late 30s.
But I remember
around the country.
I remember in the 1950s, as a little kid, I tasted my first taco in Pismo Beach, California.
There you go. But it wasn't like now where...
No, Mexican food was a southwestern thing. I mean, there was no Mexican food anywhere else in the country.
All kinds of ethnic food has gone
Much
national.
Less
it may be watered
diversity.
Down, but
you know,
but it's
in this collection of manuscripts, there's not a single Asian recipe.
And you say at that time you couldn't get a bagel between East Coast and West Coast.
Right.
And there's rye bread had to go to a Jewish deli.
And there's an Italian American woman in Vermont There was an important Italian community there because they were quarry workers. Mm-hmm. And apparently they used to get together once a year and eat Italian food together.
Once a year, big doings.
And she's describing this, and she comes to ravioli, and she explains to the reader what ravioli is. Now, that's a different America.
I should say, and everybody's got it now. What caught your eye out of all this writing? What food took you in, transported you somewhere, Mark?
Well, you know, one of the things that really struck me, because I went to college in the Midwest in Indianapolis, we forget what a rich cuisine there is in the Midwest, because in places like Indianapolis, it's completely taken over by fast food.
It's all Arby's and Wendy's.
Right. And you know, most people, if they go to the Midwest at all, it's on a highway, and they stop off at chain restaurants.
But it's true. This brought it back to me. I was home in a big barn potluck just last summer. And this is very much Midwest. And, you know, when the grandmas bring out the grandma's cooking, there is fantastic range and depth and goes right back to all the sources that come into it, the Germans and the Swedes. And you've got your Mennonites with their super rich sort of cream rhubarb pies.
And all these different pork products. Mm-hmm. And a real cuisine. I mean, there was a thing called American regional cuisine, and it was what people ate. And it was, you know, today you can still travel around France or Spain or Italy and go to different regions and have a completely different cuisine. America was like that at one time.
And it is evocative. We've got here Wisconsin sourdough pancakes, Nebraska cooks its rabbits, Washington applets and cutlets, and right on down. When we come back, we're going to taste some food out of this great collection. Mark Kalansky's new book is Food, The Food of a Younger Land. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about what Americans ate before the interstate, the freezer truck, and the dominance of industrial food, before the homogenization of America food. I'm joined today by Mark Kurlansky. He wrote Cod, he wrote Salt. His new book is The Food of a Younger Land, a portrait of American food from the lost WPA files. He dug them out from the Library of Congress, and they are from all these writings by writers in the Great Depression about the regional cuisines of America, thousands of writers who spread out around the country. Mark Kalansky has culled through their writings about the food and the culture that surrounded it. And via the magic of radio, while we've been chatting, the food itself has appeared on the table here in the studio. Mark Kalansky and I are now joined by J.J. Gonson. She's a local locavore chef with a background in short order and home cooking, founder of Cuisine and Locala Personal Chef Service. Boston Magazine here in town recently named her Best Personal Chef in Boston, no less. J.J. Gonson, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. It's an honor.
You've been cooking just down the hall.
I've been cooking a lot, yeah.
And you've been cooking out of the kind of recipes and words gathered in the Great Depression and brought to us by Mark Kurlansky in his book. What recipes did you pick out of all these chicken bog and hoe cake and all the rest? What have you got for us?
Well, it was hard, actually, to choose because there really is so much to choose from in the book. But what we did was we selected four dishes that were from different areas so that we could sort of get a sense of the different regions. There is a salad here, which is a southern salad, but very much clearly based on a German background. It's a wilted salad that is wilted with bacon fat and dressed in vinegar. So almost like a German potato salad,
Absolutely.
Except done with lettuce.
And, you know, I grew up being served this.
This
is very familiar. Sure, it's basically just nice lettuce with bacon and vinegar.
And you pour the bacon fat on it really
hot. Bacon grease and little bacon chunks in it, right?
There they are.
Yeah, little crispy chunks through it. And it turns lettuce into a substantial meal.
Right.
Not for the Great Depression.
Tons of calories in there.
Yeah, the fat has to be really hot so that it wilts the lettuce.
So it wilts the lettuce.
Yeah, okay.
And I noticed when
smells
I poured
great,
it on,
I have
it sort of wilts part of the lettuce, but part of it stays kind of crisp because it doesn't necessarily hit all of the lettuce. And so you have that sort of
variety. The range on the tongue there. And it's got that very German potato salad-y aroma. I can smell the vinegar,
vinegar
and the bacon.
Absolutely. There's the other three things here. We have a menudo, basically. It's called in the book Arizona menudo. And this is really, boy, this is poverty food.
Fancy name. I had no idea what menudo. beef tripe in this case.
This lining of the cow's stomach. And what I learned doing this in the last couple of days is that, of course, tripe is poverty food because cows have four stomachs.
Yes.
So when you slaughter a cow, you get a ton of tripe.
Okay.
So it's really cheap.
And some recipes specify which stomach to use. Yeah.
One, two, three, or four.
Right. And apparently the first one is the really good one, right? The really tender one. And then as you go down, they get...
I know tripe from Chinese food, but I have no experience with it from Arizona Menudo. Can't wait to look at that.
Right.
We're going to taste all these. What else?
Hominy. There's a chowder here, which is a main chowder, which is just potatoes, salt, pork, and onions and water.
We're talking Depression-era chowder right there.
We are, yes. No dairy.
This was a time like... Nowadays, you see more and more in newspapers and things, people are coming up with recipes for inexpensive ways of making food.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
They did a lot of that in the 30s, and this potato chowder was an example of that.
And it's delicious.
Well, we're going to come to it. And last, we've got Depression cake. Let's save that as our surprise dessert.
Can we? It's such a great story.
Before we dig into these, tell us, I mean, you're a chef, and you dug into all this work that Mark Kolanski has brought us. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And again, I love that title, The Food of a Younger Land. Mm-hmm. What did you make of the profile of the food here? What you saw as you pawed through these pages and writing and recipes, you work with food all the time. Did you feel like you were in another continent, like you were talking to the ancestors of what you do today?
You say it right in the title of the book, the refrigerator changed everything. Mm. We have the ability now to preserve things that for a long time, like butter and milk, but if you were on the farm and you didn't have an icebox, which might have been a luxury, and your cow, as we're going to get to, ran away, you were pretty much stuck with what you had, and you can salt pork and make it last forever. So all of these dishes, instead of using butter, they're using things like salt pork and bacon, which are really, you could have those around in a fairly cold spot for months, as opposed to butter, which would go fast very quickly.
Let's surf it. What do we taste first?
All right. I think I dare you to start with the tripe.
The tripe first? Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Get it out of the way.
Now, I noticed that you have a bottle of hot sauce
there. I do. In the book.
Is that for the tripe?
In the book, he makes it very clear that you put a lot of hot sauce.
Yeah. Okay.
This is from...
I recognize the hominy. There's hominy and sauce. And little bits of...
This is from Arizona, and this is very much a Mexican influence, and he talks about how no self-respecting Mexican would not enjoy tripe. And this is something where, because the stomach is such a huge thing, feed it to tons of people.
Lots of people, lots of hominy. Very familiar to me from childhood, but not with tripe. Here we go. Arizona Menudo going down with hot sauce.
Let's see.
I love hominy. I love hot sauce. And you've made the menudo a little bit the background here rather than the foreground. Hey, I could make it through the depression on this. That's pretty tasty. I
mean, globules of fat? Floating, glistening on the surface?
What were you raised on?
Well, I'm from the Northeast, so honestly, I was raised on this.
Oh.
My mother raised me on food that is not unlike this. She, of course, had a refrigerator, so she would have dairy in her chowder, but I think the chowder is fantastic without dairy. Please.
Can we dip in? Mark, what do you say in the menudo there? You've got your tripe going down. Are you in the game?
Yeah.
Hominy is great. I mean, who doesn't like hominy?
Not the hominy that gets me down. It's the...
No, it's the tripe. Okay.
Oh, I like the
menudo.
Tripe.
Let's call it menudo. It sounds like something exotic.
The texture.
I would like it with a little more tripe.
There's a ton of tripe in there. Just cooked down to nothing.
Right. Yeah, it does.
Tripe front and center. And now we've got a chowder here, which looks nothing like a clam chowder you're going to get down at the corner.
Potatoes.
It's almost an applesauce color. What's that about?
That's the salt pork.
Oh,
And the onions, which were caramelized for half an hour in salt pork.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow, it's delicious.
And I really followed that one very much to the letter, but of course there's no quantities. So I was sort of feeling it out.
Well, these writers, Mark, didn't put down recipes from a cookbook.
Example. Well, you have to understand that most of these writers had no experience with recording recipes.
Right.
They weren't even food writers. So how did the recipes work? Were they?
Well, I think that...
imagination.
Yeah, you have to sort of work on experience and imagination, but I think that they're not really recipes. They're more like ideas for how to take what you have and make it palatable, and as that, they're perfect.
Well, I'm going for this chowder, though I think I would call it bacon chowder or something. I mean, it's basically just...
Potato chowder is what they call it.
Strong pork.
It's amazing. Right. Such simple ingredients. It's such a wonderful dish.
Absolutely delicious.
Mm. Salt, pork, and onions. That's all, pretty much it in there. A little bit of pepper.
I had no idea this was going to be that good when I looked at the recipe.
And now, we're sitting here. It's 1939.
I'm very excited about this. This is the wilted salad, which I think is delicious.
It's gorgeous. That's just a little bit. So Bacon and the bacon fat and
you render the fat and then you pour the boiling fat with the little pieces of bacon that have really cooked down to nothing but what's left of the meat.
Yeah, okay. I promise I'm eating very light here on this bacon front, but I'm doing it and it looks very familiar and it's crunchy. Crunchy bacon, crunchy lettuce, and then the nice wilted part kind of meshed through. What do you say, Mark?
Ooh, of course, this isn't part
Americans
of food.
Had
this
a good time in 1939.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's great. It's really almost more a vegetable course than a salad course.
Interesting, right. Almost more like a collard or something.
But I could see this served at a restaurant, you know, right here, right now, in a sort of chichi part of town. Couldn't you? For Depression food? I mean, wouldn't...
Given me ideas.
You could put it on the menu. Menudo and wilted... I don't know about wilted lettuce. You might need a new name.
Did you run across, as I did in some of the recipes in here that I used, that there were important things missing from... the persimmon pudding recipe says, now add the milk.
Oh,
okay. Gives you no idea.
Right. Well,
well, honestly, with the chowder, it doesn't say the ratio of salt pork. I sort of assume that in the Depression, you're being conservative with the things that are important to you, so you might be more conservative with the salt pork, whereas with the potatoes, you could use a lot of water because that's free, but...
Hey, we've got a lot of listeners out there listening to us eat and wanting to get in on it. I wish we could serve it all around. We're here with Kentucky wilted lettuce, with Arizona menudo, and with what do they call the chowder?
Maine potato chowder.
Plain Maine chowder. Plain. And we're talking very plain here. No clams in this one. All food right out of the pages collected in 1938, 39.
Right. 40. And I think part of the fun of these recipes is that you do have to use some imagination.
Absolutely.
It's not all laid out for you.
And you can't
not?
Go wrong, really. Right. If you think they weren't using recipes, they were pulling what they had in the larder and
doing it. I mean, in a way, recipes themselves are real old-fashioned cooks? You wouldn't use a cookbook every day, for heaven's sakes.
No.
But we've got watering mouths around the country. Blythewood, South Carolina. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm so happy that this is the topic of conversation. I live in South Carolina, and when you get off the interstate, it is still possible to get great pulled pork barbecue. And depending on where you are in South Carolina, there are three very distinctive styles. My husband's an attorney. He spends a lot of time driving around the state, and he keeps a barbecue map in his car.
Would you?
That's exactly where to get the best style of barbecue that he's looking for.
Kim, would you know blindfolded, Kim, which one you were eating? Would you tell what part of South Carolina you were in if they put the blindfold on?
Oh, I think absolutely that you could. We've got a sort of a sweet tomato base that you find in one part of the state. Our family favorite is a very peppery vinegar-based sauce. Mm. And then I think specific to South Carolina, there is a yellow mustard sauce, which I've never encountered anywhere else.
I know where you can get it.
So I think if you've grown up on pulled pork barbecue in South Carolina, you would know where you were.
And can you get some pretty good arguments going about which is the best one?
Oh, absolutely. That's a big topic of conversation at the dining table. Everybody has their favorite. As I said, our family is a vinegar and pepper family, but there are some diehard mustard people too.
And what about the passage of time, Kim? Do you have the sense that your barbecue is changing over time? If you were to tuck in 1938, do you think it would have been very different, or is this a culinary tradition that's just, you know, kept on going, remained vibrant?
I think it's still as vibrant today as it's ever been. And when you get off of the interstate, there are some of these small sort of mom and pop barbecue houses that have been cooking the same food the same way, using the same smokehouses that they've used as long as they've been in existence.
I've got a pop quiz for you, a history quiz on South Carolina cooking. Here's an entry in Mark Karlansky's book, Food, The Food of a Younger Land. And this is by a Louise Jones DuBose, South Carolina Chicken Bog, B-O-G. Do you have a clue?
Absolutely. You can't get elected to public office in South Carolina without attending a chicken bog.
She calls it the masculine version of chicken palau.
Palau? Well, it is, and sometimes we also call it chicken purlieu or pilo.
Oh, right.
Again, depending on where you are, you hear a different pronunciation. It's largely a whole cut-up chicken and rice that's cooked together with onion and celery, salt and pepper. It's not very fancy, but But the chicken flavors, the rice, the meat is very tender. It falls off the bone. It's easy to prepare for a crowd, which I think is why you find it at political fundraisers.
Kim, you passed the pop quiz with flying colors here. Louise wrote in 1939, some like young chickens, some like more flavorsome old ones in their chicken bog. I like that. Kim, thank you very much for your call. That's just great to hear from you. Let me get one more right here from Indian Lake, New York. Brian, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to give my memory of, back after World War One. My dad raised lambs,
yeah.
Sheep,
mm-hmm.
and he raised these for the big hotels in the Blue Mountain Lake and Long Lake area.
Okay, great.
Because in those days, of course, you mentioned it earlier, you had no freezers.
Mm-hmm.
So our land here is not conducive to raising cattle because it's rough and rocky and...
But sheep don't mind. They'll do it just about anywhere.
Right. So the sheep were great. But after the refrigerated car came in, at one point he had as many as 500 sheep. But after the refrigerated car came in, that was the end of the business.
And what did people switch to?
Well, farming and logging and whatever they could do.
But I mean for eating. If they weren't eating lamb...
We went to beef because, you know, Americans like beef, seem to like beef better than lamb.
Yeah, that is a great point, sort of the, and Brian, thank you for that memory and thinking of the sheep on your rocky hillsides there. But Mark Kalansky, the way that beef kind of just took over as the king of meats, as refrigerator cars took it everywhere and we got more industrialized, all the others, I mean, you've got...
Of course, it was a big fight in the 19th century West over ranges for cattle versus sheep.
Absolutely. And beef won. They won
right.
In a big way. And that's a homogenization right there, just to take out the more common appearance of lamb. But you go way beyond that. You've got beaver tail in here from Montana. Beaver tail?
Yeah, well...
That must take some cooking.
It must.
A couple of days.
And it kind of poses the question, what happened to the rest of the beaver?
Right.
You would use the pelt, right? You would have used the pelt for, because beaver pelts would have been
valuable.
Yeah,
of course, you'd sell that.
But beavers are edible. In medieval Europe, beaver tail was valued because the church did not recognize that you couldn't eat beaver. In Lent and holidays. But you could eat the tail.
Let's read the entry.
The beaver keeps the tail in the water.
Oh, and thereby cleansed maybe.
Wow.
This is from Edward Reynolds in 1938-39. Among the rare foods of the West, because of trapping restrictions, even at that time, but still a delicacy in the Rocky Mountain area, fried beaver's tail. The tail of the beaver is held over a fire by means of a stick, pincers, or even the hand. That's living rough. When the fat softens, the skin is peeled off like a banana skin. Any other method is exceedingly difficult because the skin is tough as shoe leather and hard to separate from the flesh by means of a knife. When the fat is trimmed away, the tail may be rolled in flour and fried, JJ. When boiled, it is best pickled in vinegar in a manner similar to preparing pig's feet, that all-American favorite.
There you go.
So have it either way.
I was kind of hoping you'd make us some beaver tail, but did you check the dams on the Charles River there?
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, they're not in season.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what Americans ate before the interstate, the freezer truck, and the dominance of industrial food, before the homogenization of American food. Mark Kalansky is here. He's got a new book. It's called The Food of a Younger Land, and it's a collection of writing by writers for the WPA, Works Progress Administration, put to work by FDR in the Great Depression, thousands who spread out all over this country to collect the kind of culture and cuisine of the United States. And this is before interstates, this is before the supermarket. He writes in the book, by the 1930s, frozen food was appearing. Industrial food from the beginning of the century, such as Jell-O, factory-made bread, and cake mixes, were making huge gains in the market from new advertising vehicles such as radio. And what could better spell the beginning of the end than bottled salad dressing, the manufacture of a product that was so easy to make at home? You really bring back, Mark, this sort of, they were right on the hinge here, right, between all that was and all that would be wrapped and shrink and wrapped in plastic and frozen and canned.
My father pointed out last night that the biggest selling, one of the biggest selling foods of the time was actually canned cat food, because Starkist had figured out how to can, and they started the cat food business.
But, I mean, for cats, we hope, even though it was the Depression.
We're hoping for cats.
We've got one more dish, and then a lot of callers want to join us. J.J. Gonson, best personal chef recently named in Boston, is with us cooking up some of this. And you've got one more dish for us. We've had wilted lettuce, menudo tripe, plain Maine chowder, and here, Depression cake. What is that?
Well, if cooking is art, baking is science. So this is really a wonderful cake. It actually, I think, is very delicious. What happened here in the story is Ethel went to her pantry to create a 4th of July specialty and discovered that she had no butter, no eggs, no milk, and her cow apparently had run off after a bull.
This is the story you've got from the Depression Era writers out of the Foot of a Younger Landmarks book here, okay?
And Ethel put together what she had.
She needed cake, had no ingredients.
Right. Now, what I find is really interesting is that even at this time, Ethel does have spices. She has ginger, clove, nutmeg, allspice, salt, sugar. And so what she creates
I smell those. It looks kind of like a gingerbread.
It's like a gingerbread.
Okay.
And what she does is she takes flour, water, spices, and leavenings, baking powder and baking soda, which, of course, would be shelf-stable, and good old pork fat, bacon fat, again, shelf stable.
You say water, but I read raisin water. What is
raisin
that?
Raisin water. I'm so sorry. I should have said she says that she has a bowl of raisins stewing, and she uses the water from the raisins. And I would love to know more about those stewing raisins. I think what I sort of picture is that she can get her hands on dried raisins, which are probably hard as rocks. So to use them, she's stewing them to make them soft as something for her family to eat, and she doesn't want to
just throw
that water away. And she uses the raisin water to flavor her cake.
She gets depression.
And this is cake. Far West, so I have this picture of her out in a sort of a shanty, a bungalow almost. And
she was preparing for a July 4th picnic, rodeo, and general get-together Depression cake.
Wow. And how is it?
Is there sugar, or does the sweetness come from the raisin water?
There is sugar in it. Yep.
Oh. Well, it's good.
It's good.
I mean,
it's good and easy.
Everybody's got a little bowl of raisin water hanging around.
And cheap.
Very smooth.
And very cheap.
Is that the pork fat?
Yes. Yep. But beautiful, what we say in baked bread, development. Nice crumb. It holds together even though there's no egg in it.
Now, was this recipe entirely there, or did you have to improvise?
I'll tell you, this recipe was written as a recipe, literally a half a teaspoon of this, a cup of this, a tablespoon of that. She has a cup and 3/4 of flour. She obviously was documenting as she created it.
We have listeners listening very closely to us, happily munching on depression cake. Let's go to Melanie in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Melanie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Forgive my chewing, Melanie. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Oh, please, chew away.
So rude.
I'm calling mainly because I'm interested in the format of this book and the fact that it was written by a bunch of secretaries and school teachers and other people who are
and real writers, some of whose names you'll know,
and some brilliant
and my
novelists
question
and poets.
Why can't the current stimulus package be used in such a way, not just to employ, you know, green technologies and all that kind of stuff, but those of us in the arts or writers who would love to, weigh in on this.
But is it interesting to go out and write about Americans popping lean cuisine in the microwave? I mean, does that have the same charm, Melanie?
Well, I'm sure that there must be some sort of parallel to today's world. Maybe we wouldn't be writing about what our moms are making on the farm, but
people need the jobs. That's for
well,
sure.
Well, you know what the difference is. Roosevelt did a very smart thing. I mean, he got a law passed which created a budget, and it said that this was a budget to create small work projects, and it didn't specify what those work projects were. So Congress just voted on this overall budget. Congress never voted on the WPA, and it never voted on the Federal Writers Project. These things were created by executive order. If Obama had been able to pass an open-ended bill like that, he could do the same thing. The truth is that the Federal Writers Project never would have been passed by Congress. And a lot of people in Congress were very angry about it.
Melanie, do you have an old food story from your family?
I do. I'm almost 50 years old, but my parents are old enough to be my grandparents. So my mom's in her 90s now, and she is from Arizona. My dad was from a farm in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And my mom to this day can't eat a meal without having a little tin of jalapeno peppers next to her plate just because she's the complete WASP, but there was so much Mexican influence in her life growing up and in the foods that she brought back east here.
So it lives, it lives. And there's a vote for writing up some more right now. Melanie, thanks. Let's get one a call from Buffalo, New York. Whitney, you're on the air.
Hi. So I was just calling. I'm 25. I was born and raised in Buffalo, but my mom is from Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was little, we would go to Kansas, and my grandmother would cook, you know, these incredible meals, most of which were made with food from her garden. And now, unfortunately, my grandmother's passed, and we have an entirely different sort of Midwestern meal when we go out there, and it's mostly that fast food that you talked about, or some sort of casserole involving a Campbell's soup, cream of mushroom, or something
and
like that.
And maybe some Velveeta.
Some Velveeta. But anyway, I have this great memory of my grandmother, and I think it speaks to that Great Depression mindset, if you will. And it's, you know, she and I were driving one day past the town sewer pond, and she saw a turtle, and she wanted to pull over the car so she could get the turtle so she could make turtle soup. It was one of her favorite things. And we were like, that's disgusting. Don't do that. Keep driving.
You that's know? The sewer pond, Grandma. Hey, what makes the mussels tasty, do you think? You know, what escargot doesn't get it from nowhere. So did you put a fork into that, a spoon, Whitney?
No, I'm a vegetarian.
So did you become a vegetarian that day?
That was the moment.
But what did she say? Did you say that, like, that's good food? What are you kids talking about? Let's get that in the stock pot?
Yeah, she actually said, you know, if you can shell a turtle, you deserve to eat it. It's tough work.
Well, that I can attest to.
I believe that. I would believe that.
That's true. What an image. Grandma hopping out of the car to grab the turtle. But we're sorry she's not still making you those great old-style meals. And we hope somebody is preserving them out there. Maybe Mark's book will help on that front. Thank you for calling. Let's get one from Mildred in Bristol, Rhode Island. Mildred, you're on the air.
Hi. Another grandma story.
Good.
So we used to, my twin sister and I used to go up to northern Michigan to the Keweenaw Peninsula right off of Lake Superior.
Yeah.
And this was in the 30s. I was born in 1930. And I remember everything, you know, of course, came right from the earth and was very elemental. No other steps in between. So grandma used to run around catching a chicken for a Sunday dinner, and then she would chop the head off. And I remember her, and of course, it ran around like a chicken with its head chopped off.
And oh, the nerve.
Her running around trying to catch the chicken again. And
how could these chickens be such stereotypes?
Cheeky chickens.
Yeah, but and then we used to each adopt a calf, you know, at the beginning of the summer, and mine ended up as veal chops at the end of the summer. And of course, everything was, you know, free range and very delicious. And she did everything on a wood stove because there was no electricity. But it was in a huge half-acre kitchen garden. It was straight from the earth. They had a root cellar. They called it a root cellar.
Sure.
Not a root cellar.
Mm-hmm.
Where they stored things for the winter. Mm-hmm. And we had the finished pasties, which are really Cornish. What I remember is everything was straight from the earth and the animal, you know. There was
Mildred, you make that very vivid for us and bring it back. And I have to say that you can read that and feel that in all of these dishes, that the distance that we've put into our food system really does make a difference, and you can taste it. Let me get one more. James in Canton, Connecticut. James, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
And
JJ's right here cooking.
I'm a PhD student at the University of Connecticut studying American gastronomy.
Okay.
And that's a term that meets with some raised eyebrows sometime. And I'm wondering if this, what we're describing, the food habits of our past, isn't the original, quote-unquote, American gastronomy. If it is, how do we move forward with it, past frozen and convenience meals and fast food? Can we do that? My question specifically directed at Mr. Kurlansky.
Mark, take it, and then JJ, that's kind of your thing. But Mark, first, from all your reading here, can we navigate back?
Well,
food is an evolving thing. So, I mean, even to say that this food from 1940 was the original American cuisine.
Not.
It wasn't. It has layers on it, like you were talking about the wilted lettuce having German overtones. And, you know, that's what makes food so interesting, is that it tells you about changes in the economy, changes in immigration. Everything changes food. So to go back would be an artificial thing, and artificial things in food don't last.
Well, but would it be artificial? I mean, a lot of people are working right now to go back, if going back means eating more locally, eating more closer to the earth, as Mildred said.
You can go back in that sense, eat more locally, eat small farms, things like that, but it wouldn't be the same food.
Not the same food, but JJ, this is, you're part of the local vore movement, eat local. Could you feel that breathing in these older recipes? Is there something of going back in what people like yourself are looking to do to go forward?
I think that there's a misunderstanding about how we eat now that has to do with thinking that to eat well, we have to eat complicated food, and that the recipes here, if you want to call them recipes, or the ways of preparing food here are not complicated. There's not a lot of complicated sauces or elaborate combinations of, you know, nobody's whipping egg whites and folding them into special flours. And I do think that we maybe have gotten to a time when we think that you have to unwrap this lean cuisine that has this very elaborate flavors, and we forget that, in fact, there's more nutrients in something that's a little less elaborate.
But the nuance of flavor is abundant here.
Absolutely.
In a way, what we maybe have a distance from is that organic understanding of the flavors.
Right.
We need fancy recipes,
frou-frou
and shishi.
This food is not intellectualized.
Right. No.
This is a food that comes out of the reality of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
But it's incredibly subtle.
Right.
But
at the same time, there's all kinds of subtle, wonderful flavors here.
I feel like I hear people say a lot that they don't have time to cook.
Mm.
And that, when I hear that, I say, well, you don't have time to boil rice and slice some vegetables. Like, you don't have to make a souffle.
Turn the perspective a little bit, and maybe you do.
Yeah, and the food will always taste better if the ingredients are fresh.
Let's get a call from Tybee Island, Georgia. Rick, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to call and comment on the ladies further up the coast here in South Carolina. You inquired of her whether that pulled pork would have tasted different. And I would propose that our entire domestic food supply for animals, fruits, and vegetables has been engineered so much since 1939. Look at how different the hog is now, how much less, more lean meat it has on it. The butterball turkey, the difference of it from the other ones. Chickens. They used to run around and eat everything off the ground. Now they're eating the things. What they eat affects how they taste and how we engineer them. Here in Tybee Island, this is part of the low country.
Yes.
The popular low country boil is down here, and that's primarily seafood. And I would imagine that would be much closer tasting to what it would be like back 40 years ago, because most of it is wild caught.
I've enjoyed that low country boil on Tybee Island, and hopefully coming from the sea it is closer to the original, but we've got a lot of engineering. I appreciate your call. I want to get one more here if I can from Salt Lake City. Marjorie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just wanted to comment that I grew up hunting squirrels, and we had squirrel stew, and my grandmother made sourdough pancakes with rabbit gravy. I grew up with that. And I didn't hear you talk about lockers. You know, we used to butcher on our farm. I wasn't allowed to watch it, of course. But and then we would take the meat to the locker in town, and because we didn't have freezers, and we'd pay, you know, a monthly fee for that.
Keep it chilled cooled there, yeah.
Yeah, and I miss this food. I mean, my grandmother made head cheese that was superb, not like anything you buy in the store. And we would render lard and things like that. We would get to go to the store and pick out our fabric for what our shirts were from our flour bags.
Sure, I remember those squirrels too. Do you remember it fondly? Would you like it? Was it
what kind of squirrels?
Oh, it was absolutely delicious. I mean, you know, and we had the smelt run up at Lake Superior. My dad, they'd go up with some huge wash tubs and things like that, and then we would cook it. And the food was delicious. It was very healthy. We had a lot of food. We didn't have anything else, but we had a lot of food, and we had a lot of good social activities. And people, the book, It Takes a Village to, you know, to Raise the Children, our entire town, as it was called in the country, raised all of our kids. I mean, we never would have ever thought of that, talking to anybody that told
us. And making the food and gathering the food, a big part of that. Marjorie, thanks so much for that memory of squirrel stew and head cheese. We're really back in old country there. Mark Kalansky, it's really interesting when the phone lines have just been jammed. People really respond to this. There's a vestigial longing for the food that you describe in the pages here.
I think that we all, in these times, feel like we're losing our culture, and people are trying to, you know, hang on to who we are and what our culture and what our traditions are. And you see that a lot in food.
Well, it's been a great day. We enjoyed a meal and an hour together. J.J. Gonson, founder of Cuisine en Locale, personal chef service in Boston. Best personal chef, some would say, and very recently. This has been great. Thank you so much for your cooking and your thoughts today, JJ.
Thank you, Tom.
And Mark Kurlansky, we loved you on Cod and on Salt, and now The Food of a Younger Land, the new book just out today. Thanks for gathering all this.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us, and enjoy your weekend cuisine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.